when we lose someone, everything changes. The experience is a terrible milestone that can bring everything to a standstill. To heal, we need to be able to lean on the right tools that help guide us forward and support us through our ups and downs. The only guarantee in life is that it doesn't go on forever. For those left behind after a loved one dies, the grief can be utterly crippling. But the process of recovering is often misunderstood or misrepresented. We never get over it, and we shouldn't, says our guest today. Sherry Cormier is a psychologist, a grief expert, and a widow. And she's going to tell her story and what she has found as an effective way to deal with grief and loss. She's a consultant and public speaker and formerly on the faculty of the University of Tennessee and West Virginia University, and is the author of Counseling Strategies and Interventions for Professional Helpers, and the co-author of Interviewing and Change Strategies for Helpers. It's our pleasure to have on the show today Sherry Cormier, Dr. Cormier. Sherry, how are you doing today?
Man, I'm doing great. I'm healthy, I'm happy, I'm doing my life's work, and how are you?
I'm doing good. Your publicity kit said, Sherry Cormier had it all. A thriving marriage to a loving husband, a vibrant career as a psychologist, a new home, a closely connected family of parents and daughters. But in a startlingly short span, these anchors were ripped away. Her husband was diagnosed and died of cancer within 6 months. Her mother, father, sister, and even a loved dog passed away. She was left reeling and stunned by a sharp, unendurable grief, yet endure she did. You want to fill us in a little more on your story?
Sure, I'd be happy to, and just, you know, really hope to reach your listeners with it. You know, about 10 years ago, my life was moving along, just like you described, Wynn, and then I had really a series of pretty strong losses. My father died. Now, he was older, so that was expected. But 3 months after my dad died, my husband, who had just been diagnosed with stage 4 terminal inoperable cancer, died. So I basically lost the two most important men in my life within 3 months. Then a couple years after that, my mother died. Then, as you mentioned, my dog that I had rescued to sort of, you know, provide some sort of companionship after my husband died, my dog died at age 7. And then a year ago, my only sibling, my sister, died. So, you know, I was sort of really, to be honest, probably living a really good life, maybe a charmed life even. I really was not personally that well acquainted with loss and grief and bereavement. I had plenty of clients who were, but, you know, there's nothing like having lived experience to really help us know what's going on.
You know,
go ahead.
Someone said, you can't empathize or understand someone unless you walked a mile in their shoes. It's an old Indian saying.
Well, and I think that's true, and I hesitate a minute on this because I have been in the business of training people to become therapists, and this is sort of an age-old question of, you know, do you have to have a firsthand experience to really be able to help someone? And I think the answer really to that is it depends. It just depends. But I will tell you this, to be perfectly honest, I was thrown for a loop myself, even though I'm a psychologist. Experiencing all of these losses for myself, hit me in a way that I was just stunned initially, and I thought, I don't know as much about grief as I thought I did until it happened to me. So I think there is some truth to that, Wynn, that we walk better in someone else's shoes when we've been through it and we know what the heck is going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that try to comfort the bereaved individual and everything. Mm-hmm. Comments like that, well, I can't even think of the comments, but I know that they do it. And
well, like, I think a common one is, there's a reason for this.
Yes.
Or, I know exactly how you're feeling.
That's the one I was trying to... You don't know exactly how one's feeling unless you've gone through those feelings yourself.
Exactly. And, you know, even then, I'm not sure. I probably even myself, even as a loss survivor and a bereavement trauma specialist, would probably not say to someone else who's grieving, I know how you feel, because grief is such an individual journey. We all have our own ways of coping with grief. It's a journey that we take individually, although we need lots of social support to get through it. But I think it impacts everyone differently. And so I don't know exactly how someone feels. I mean, you know, I've talked to some people that have lived with, you know, that have had loved ones die, but they've been caring for them for a very long time, and so they're sad when their loved one dies, but there's also a sense of relief. That's a very different kind of feeling than someone in my town here where I live who was a journalist reporter and got shot to death 2 months ago at work by someone who just came in and gunned people down with an assault rifle. Those survivors of that kind of loss are likely going to have different feelings than someone who's been, you know, maybe caring for a loved one for 10 years who's had dementia. So grief can have all kinds of shades to it and varieties of experiences. So I think it is best to not say, I know how you feel, or there's some reason for this.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
We're talking about grief as a result of death. Now, does your book help people with grief as a result of other losses that might be just as significant as losing a loved one?
Well, it does. And you know, it's the name of my book, Wynn, came to me in a dream. Actually, it's called Sweet Sorrow. And so maybe the first few chapters of the book do talk about my own personal journey of loss and, you know, the hurdles that I went through and how I learned to heal. But the two-thirds of the rest of the book is just really about tools for healing from loss. And there's something that many of us do experience. It's actually a really great thing, because for some of us, loss is very stressful and can be traumatic. And this is a relatively new phenomenon we call post-traumatic growth. So I talk about that in Sweet Sorrow and how, you know, how do we not stay stuck in grief? But how do we learn? It's not like we get over it, and as you said in the introduction, we really shouldn't get over it, because grief, our goal is to integrate it and incorporate it, but not to forget. So how do we find ways to really grow and really thrive? Because I believe any kind of loss, if you're losing your house because you're in that awful hurricane flood down there, or you lost a job, or you went through a divorce, or you lost had a miscarriage, any kind of loss, I think loss itself can be a catalyst for growth and for awakening.
Okay, so let's get in. This is a content-rich program, and I try to give my listeners some great content, and I noticed that you had 8 tools that you can lean on to help overcome the pain and the heartbreaking loss and begin to feel better. So let's go through that, and I will name them, and you tell us something about them, okay?
Perfect. That's wonderful. Okay. I'd love that.
Willingness.
Willingness, yeah. Well, willingness, the other word for that could be flexibility. I think what happens to us when we experience loss, and regardless of whether it's loss of a person or something precious to us, a house or a job or even a dream we had that isn't going to materialize, you know, we get so attached to our plans, and when we incur a loss, our plans go out the window. So willingness is really being able to let go, and let go of familiarity, let go of the way that things used to be, and really make room or make space to embrace the new, whatever the new will be.
Okay. The second tool is play.
Play. Yeah, now play seems like a funny tool, right, when we talk about grief. Because, you know, you think, well, I'm feeling awfully sorrowful and awfully sad, and you're telling me to have play. But, you know, grief is a heavy emotion. And, you know, one of the best things that someone ever said to me, and this was, you know, from a fellow psychologist who had, they had lost, he and his wife had lost a daughter. He said, you've got to take breaks from grief. You've got to find ways to distract yourself. And so think about things that you used to do or you'd like to do for fun. And, you know, maybe go to a movie, watch something funny. I used to watch Seinfeld replays all the time for the first couple years on TV. Listen, you know, look at comedies, read jokes. I would read Reader Digest jokes. Pets, I think playing with a pet or if you are around a little person, playing with a kid or playing with a pet, you get a different kind of energy from that, and that tends to lighten your grief.
Well, I can understand that, but I can also understand that there's lots of people that would say, I just feel so sad, so sorrowful, I don't feel like playing.
Right.
So what do you say then?
Well, so, and of course I would say, well, try it. You know, try it, and, you know, humor is good, but what I might say in that case, there's two things I might say in that case, four other tools. Well, I would go to other tools. One would be inspiration. And that is if you don't think you could, let's say you don't think you could handle a comedy or going to hear a comedian, find something that inspires you. So it might be a podcast that's very uplifting. It might be uplifting music. It might be going to some sort of religious service. I'm big on nature. Getting outside, I think trees have a very calming energy. So being amidst, you know, the woods and the forest and hiking in the trees. But anything that would be inspirational, I think, would be good. Some kind of spiritual practice is great for healing from loss, whether it's prayer or meditation, but anything that involves a connection to spirituality.
Okay. That was number three, and number four is blessings.
And blessings. So, you know, blessings is maybe another way to talk about gratitude. And this is also sort of a strange way to think about healing from grief. And I'll, again, being honest, it's hard to be grateful and be sad. It's hard to be grief-stricken and be grateful at the same time. You know, when you lose something or someone really valuable, you know, you feel often very angry. Why did this person or this thing get taken away from me? But we, as hard as it is, I think one of the most powerful ways to heal from loss is to remember there's always blessings. So I would start small. I would start every night by thinking about one thing or one person that happened to me that day that I felt grateful for. And I would write it down, and then the next night I'd think of some other different person or different experience or different thought or feeling I had that I felt grateful for. And even just basic things like, I mean, yes, I lost the love of my life and I've now lost my family of origin, yet, I mean, I have my sight, I have my hearing, I have my health, I'm mobile, I'm able to talk, I'm able to think, I have my mind. People, of course, with dementia don't anymore. I have my memories. I have a roof over my head. I have a house that's not flooded. I mean, there's so many things around us that we, if we just become mindful and write, I'm convinced writing it down is helpful.
Well, I think that gratitude is one of the most important spiritual things that we can do to make our lives better. And I tell people that if first thing when they get up in the morning, if they can list 5 or 10 things that they're grateful for, their whole day will be different. And
yeah.
It doesn't have to be just after a loss. It could be
I like it for healing from loss. In general, I think if all of us were to practice gratitude and random acts of kindness win, that we would have a much more peaceful, loving world.
Let's take a break in these tools for a second and tell us how to get your book.
Okay. The book is called Sweet Sorrow. The subtitle is Finding Enduring Wholeness After Loss and Grief. And you can go to any online bookseller, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, and order it there. It might be in your local bookstore or your local library. You can check my website, which is www.sherry, S-H-E-R-R-Y, Cormier, C-O-R-M-I-E-R, author, AUTHOR.com. And I also have a Facebook page in case you want to contact me.
Great. Okay, so you know now how to get a copy of this book. It's a great book. Let's get back to some of the content in your book. Another tool is education.
Yes, and that to me is one of the more important tools for healing from loss. And that was what I was going to say. If you felt like you just could not do anything fun or playful or, you know, try to laugh, which, you know, laughter is such good medicine, then education is another good bet, because curiosity and learning are really incompatible with sorrow and despair. It's very hard to be sad when you're engaged with doing something or learning something new. If you're doing a new dance step or learning how to speak Spanish, when you're focused on learning something new, chances are you're not going to be thinking about how sad you feel. And we know from neuroscience that, in fact, when we learn or try something new, it activates the midbrain area, and it increases the release of a feel-good hormone called dopamine. So we know, neuroscience tells us, that curiosity and learning really do make our brains feel better. So I say, make Google your friend, go to a lecture, read a book. But when you get engrossed in learning something, you are just not going to be as grief-stricken.
I'd like to take it in a different direction for one moment.
Sure.
And say that I've been doing work in healing people's addictions for 35 years. And all of these addictions are due to low self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to increase your self-esteem, one of the 5 principles that I have in my book is education. And I tell people that they should be actively involved in learning something every day, whether reading or listening to something or going to hear a speaker or whatever, for the rest of their life, because that's going to increase their self-esteem. And as their self-esteem increases, their chance of holding on to the addiction decreases. So it's not only if you have a loss, but you need to be involved in educating yourself, regardless of who you are, what type of circumstances you find yourself in, if you want to have the best life possible.
I just say 100% of that. I think we need to be, regardless of our situation, we need to be lifelong learners. That's so important for our own well-being and really the well-being of the world.
Absolutely. Okay. Your number six tool is connection.
Connection. And this probably, in a way, should be number one, but except for me, it all starts with willingness. But it should be number one in the sense that I think connection with other people is imperative for healing from loss. And, of course, I know what you're going to say after this win. You're going to say it's also imperative for healing from addiction.
Yeah.
But, you know, because the reason it's so important in addiction and in loss is because we're hardwired to have close companionships with other people. And so when we, especially if we lose a person, then we've lost a confidant. And so we have to think about who do we have around us that we can tell our story to, who's trustworthy that we can talk to. You know, it could be a support group. It could be a therapist, but it just might be close friends or a social group. But I can't stress this more. Really, trustworthy connections are probably the biggest thing you want to get in your life to heal sadness. So find your tribe.
Well, you need to find the right connection.
And the right connection, yeah, not, yeah, exactly. People that are going to be uplifting and trustworthy and good listeners.
I had a client once that lost his wife, and so he went into a bar and found a bartender that was sympathetic and talked to him and everything. So he developed that connection, but as he developed that connection, he also connected with the alcohol on a daily basis.
So. And you know, because you and I talked about this on our pre-interview, see, I think that the level of emotional pain can be so great during loss that if we don't use the right tools, we increase our vulnerability to get addicted, or if we're in recovery, our relapse potential increases. So you're absolutely right. We can want to self-medicate our feelings of emotional pain from loss with substances instead of like using good self-care practices or doing some of these other more healthy tools. And then we develop a second issue to deal with.
Right. Okay, number seven is balance.
Yes. My balance, I am really talking about really effective self-care practices. Like, grief is disruptive, loss is disruptive, because, you know, we're going along one day, we're in our house, a hurricane hits, and all of a sudden, we can't get in and out of our neighborhood, we've lost power, you know, our home gets flooded. That's a lot of disruption. So loss is like that. It takes away our balance. So how do we stay in good balance? We practice good self-care. So the most important aspects of that would be eating really healthy food, not processed junk food, getting consistent exercise, and getting consistent and sufficient amounts of sleep. Those are the big three, because loss can really put a lot of stress on our bodies. Our bodies have some physiological reaction to loss, so nutrition, exercise, and sleep are so important.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
And again, even in healing addictions, they're a big three in that, too.
Well, I think, you know, all three of those things are important, but if you don't get sleep on a regular basis,
yeah,
hard to really make fast progress.
It really is, because sleep disrupts your centers that control hunger, and appetite control, and then you don't feel like you want to move your body. So I would say sleep is key as well.
Okay, and Sherry, your final point is transformation.
Right, transformation, and really by, I mentioned this earlier, but I do think loss can be a catalyst for growth. And so, you know, when we lose something or someone, we've sort of ended a chapter, but yet something else is beginning. And so we're usually not the same person. You know, loss can change us in very positive ways. And so noticing what is shifting in you, and I just read something where it's so important, and this goes along with that lifelong learning, to always be able to make your future bigger than your past. That's key for healing.
What do you think is the significance of developing a mission in life after loss?
I think that's key because, getting back to that thing that I mentioned earlier, the phenomenon called post-traumatic growth. You know, in post-traumatic growth, really what happens is our philosophy of life and our perspective shifts. And one of the ways that we grow rather than stay stuck in loss is we make a connection with our life purpose or our life mission. We really get connected to our calling. Like, what am I here for? What's important for me? What is my life's work in the world? And that kind of connection to that mission is really key to transformation and growth.
Absolutely. I want to quote you. Loss leaves us traumatized and reeling, but it's important to know that it is possible to regain our equilibrium and rediscover ourselves after heartbreak and grief. We can recognize that something deep within ourselves has shifted. We have changed, grown, possibly even thrived. When that happens, we've regained our footing and come back to the land of the living while holding the memory of the loss within our hearts. I think that's just beautiful.
Thank you so much. That is a quote from Sweet Sorrow. I don't know what page, but I remember writing it.
Well, they can get your book, and then they can look for it, and then they can underline it.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Wynn.
I don't, you know, lawyers say you should always know the answer to any question before you ask it, but I'm not a lawyer, so I'm going to ask you how you cultivate the five seeds of resilience.
Oh, that's a great question. I love getting that question. Well, you know, three of them we just talked about. Three of the five seeds, well, actually four of them we've talked about, maybe all of them, but I'll just go through them quickly. So sleep, exercise, and nutrition are all very important seeds for strengthening resilience. And in fact, when your sleep suffers, you're eating a lot of junk food and you're not getting any exercise, what we know is that your moods also suffer. So those are important. Sleep, exercise, nutrition. Number four would be social support or connection. And I didn't really say this before, but you know, grief itself is sort of a lonely experience. Now, sometimes we can find comfort in being in a support group, but that's not for everyone. Everyone doesn't like to do that. And so loneliness, we know now, is a killer. You know, it increases our stress hormones. It impairs our brain functioning. So we need to be selective in who we pick as friends, but we really need to develop and nourish friendships. So that's the fourth seed to resilience. And then the fifth seed to resilience, which we touched on, would be meditation. And some people believe meditation is the most important seed for resilience, because if you meditate every day and you do it for a period of time, several months, it really does shift the brain. It changes the brain. It makes the brain more resilient. It calms the brain. It impacts and increases the functioning of the immune system. So most people believe that probably the single best seed or tool for developing resilience is a meditation practice.
Well, in my therapy plan for getting over your addictions mm-hmm. at home without having to pay anybody any money, there's five steps, and the most important step, of course, is the spiritual step.
Right.
Because it increases your self-esteem permanently, and with a good self-esteem, you don't need to be chasing other things in life that aren't good for you. But one of the subparts of that is prayer and meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And so if more people would pray and then they would stop and listen and meditate, they would find that it changes their entire life. And unless you've done that, you may not believe me, but I can tell you from personal experience and from the experience of many, many, many people that I've talked to that are trying to get over addiction, that prayer and meditation is very important. So it's also important in getting over your grief.
Really, I see so many overlaps between your, you know, what you do on addiction and what I do on healing from loss.
Right, right.
A lot of overlap, and definitely prayer and meditation, really for well-being in general.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you don't have to be recovering from an addiction or healing from a loss to get to reap the benefits of prayer and meditation. It's kind of like lifelong learning.
There's a lot of topics that we've talked about already and that we haven't, that if people could educate themselves to them and their value to themselves as a person, that would be really wonderful, you know, I mean. However, you know, people are busy with their jobs and raising their families and everything, and sometimes don't have the time or don't take the time to learn about these things that we've been talking about. Another one is forgiveness. People don't understand what forgiveness is, how critical it is with respect to how your life goes. I talked with Deepak Chopra a while back, and you know, he has a kind of way of looking at things that are a little different than conventional medicine. But he told me that he thought that other than things like breaking bones and being in a car wreck and everything, that most of the illness in the world was in some respect due to anger. Anger is resentment, it's unforgivingness, and if you hold on to that inside your body, it will kill you with stress, attacks, strokes, all kinds of things. So I'm not sure that he's not right, but I am sure.
He's an amazing healing presence himself.
Yes.
And I think people who are unable to forgive or even just to let go, you know, we can't just hold on to, we can't keep grudges and hold on to things and become bitter, because then I think our arteries harden, you know. So I think there's definitely something to what he's saying.
Well, the point that he was trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you don't forgive somebody, that person hardly ever knows it or cares about it. You're the one that it affects.
Yes, really forgiveness, I think, is most of all, it's more of a gift to myself than it is even to the other person.
Sure.
Because when I forgive and I let go of all of that resentment and anger that I've stored up, I become a much more peaceful person and feel better.
Right. Less stress on your body means you'll probably live longer.
Exactly.
There was a point that I don't know too much about, but I'll ask you. How does your work and what you teach and everything correlate with cancer? Cancer is such a horrifying diagnosis. You've had it in your life, and I've had it in mine. Whenever you think of cancer, you think of dying. And so What's your thoughts on cancer?
Well, I have a very special interest in cancer because I had a perfectly healthy husband who had blood work done, perfectly normal blood work, 6 weeks before he was diagnosed with stage 4 terminal cancer. So that's pretty shocking, you know, when you think, well, how can someone have perfectly normal blood work and then 6 weeks later you're being told you're dying and you're going to die and that you had a tumor in your body for 4 years. And that's what we were told. So I think that health and well-being is very holistic, though, and this is where I like Deepak Chopra's work. You know, the body is influenced, I think, in so many ways by, certainly, yes, what we eat, exercise is important, but I think spiritually, I think if we're in a state of spiritual starvation, that impacts our body and can impact our genes, and then that can impact our cells and can cause cancer cells to grow and not get shut down by our immune system. You know, there's a field actually called psychoimmunology that talks about the relationship between some of the things that Chopra's talking about, like resentment and cancer. You know, holding on to damaging emotions and not letting them go, and they infiltrate the body really at a cellular level. And that stuff over time can, you know, I mean, certainly there's environmental toxins that produce cancers, and there's genes that produce cancers and mutations of genes. But, you know, from a holistic standpoint, to me, everything is connected. And so it is really important, if we're spiritually connected or, you know, spiritually stagnant, if we're in a good emotional state, if we're forgiving, but if we're, you know, emotionally bankrupt, holding on to resentment, we're not in a good place emotionally, we're eating a lot of junk food, we're stressing ourselves, you know, stress is, I think, a big contributor to cancer and many illnesses. Those are all things that, over time, can really impact the immune system in such a way that it can't fight off abnormal cells, and then they can develop into cancer.
It's interesting. Sometimes something hits your brain that you hadn't thought about in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about this story about this guy that went to his doctor, and he said, "Doctor, you've told me that I've got cancer and I've got 6 months to live." And I was just thinking, I'm not going to be able to pay your bill in 6 months. And the doctor says, well, in that case, I'll give you another 6 months. So what was the truth behind that is that nobody, whether they've got a medical degree or they're a psychologist or they've had plenty of experience, knows what's going to happen to you as an individual. And they can't tell you that. And if you listen to people and you go away from that experience by saying, well, I've got between 6 and 12 months to live, you invite into your body, into your brain, into your mentality and everything what you think about.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's really such an astute observation. I think, I imagine that physicians have some responsibility. They have to try to balance hope with reality, hope with information. But I think, you know, as soon as you hear sort of a negative prognosis, you can't help. But you've heard it. You know, you've heard it. And I don't know exactly how they get around that, but you know, you can say to someone, I think this is a very, very serious illness, and we're going to do everything we can to try to help you recover from it. Of course, there are no guarantees, and a lot of this is going to be up to your own healing. But I know people that have been living with cancer for 25 30 years that, you know, probably should have been dead several times and are still alive and doing pretty well. And I know other people that, you know, maybe had a not that difficult of a cancer, you know, not in terms of, you know, maybe a lower stage to cancer, that died very suddenly. So it is not in our hands, any physician or anyone's hands, to know what is our individual path and when we're born and when we die. But, you know, the role of how we think is so important in healing from anything, whether it's loss or illness or addiction, I think. I agree with you 100%.
I believe it was Albert Einstein that said, there's two ways of looking at this. You can believe that nothing is a miracle, or you can believe that everything's a miracle.
Yes, and I choose to believe the latter.
I choose the latter. So, you know, I've had clients and patients over the years that have had diagnosis by their physician that they would be dead in 6 months, and lo and behold, 6 months they were still alive, and they're still alive 20 years later, like you said. So I think that you ought to try to use this truth that you can't go on what people tell you necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
You can take advice and everything, but to live your life based on what somebody has told you is not smart.
Right, no. I mean, I think you have to really try to, if you get that sort of information, try to just do as much as you can possibly do to heal your body and your mind and spirit and forge ahead and believe that you're going to be able to overcome whatever it is, you know, whether it's an illness or addiction or loss or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed this conversation, Sherry. Is there anything else that you would like to tell our audience before we wrap it up?
Well, I just want to say that I've been so honored to be here today with you, Wynn, and I've also really enjoyed it, and I so appreciate talking with your listeners. And I just want to say to any listener that if you're in a hard place right now, that I've been in hard places too, and that I believe it is possible to heal from loss and grow from a hard place. And, you know, in fact, maybe I'll just end with this quick little story that a friend of mine once said to me, and it's sort of what you just were talking about, Wynn, about when physicians give you, quote, bad news. She said, you know, there's really no such thing as bad news. There's just news. We don't really know whether news is going to become good or bad. So if we just remember there's news, there's an event that's happened, but we don't, if we, you know, don't have to label it as a bad thing, because we don't really know exactly what the outcome is going to be, and we just put our whole heart in our whole being in healing in the best way that we can. And I have faith that your listeners can and will do so.
Following up on that point, you can have something happen to you in your life, and you say to yourself, as I did back in 1990, this is the worst, most horrible thing that could ever happen to me.
Yes.
But then 20 years later, I'm saying, that was the best thing that ever could happen to me.
Yes. I mean, you know, I've known people that have gotten laid off from their dream job that just said the same thing. And 1 year later, or 2 years later, they were offered an even better position with greater pay, greater benefits, something that they had not even imagined they would be doing.
Yes. Okay, so I would like to plug my book for a second. It's called Freedom from Addiction, and then the number 3, because it's Actually, it's the fifth in a series of books about addiction, but it's the third in a series with that title. And the website is the same, freedomfromaddiction3.com. And either you that are listening, or a family member, or somebody that's important to you today is suffering from an addiction. And there's over 30 different kinds of addictions that I'm talking about here. If you would like to find out what are the symptoms of the disease, how do I know that I have the disease, what are the forms of the disease, how does it affect people and everything, you can go to my podcast on iTunes, which is called Freedom from Addiction, and you have to search for it under my name. But that's free, and there's about 90 different programs that you can listen to find out about some of these things that you never thought about before and you don't understand. And if you did understand, you'd have a better idea of how this whole concept of addiction works. So I implore you to take a minute or two, get on the podcast, listen to it. Possibly you might want to get a book. You can get it at Amazon. And I think that will be a great benefit for you, your family, your relatives, and your close friends and everything. So I just invite you to do that. And I just
thank you for the work in the world you're doing on addictions, because it's such a huge issue confronting so many people in so many different ways.
Well, I have written that addiction is the worst illness in the world.
It's very, very, and it's so prevalent now.
Because it affects everybody.
It does.
Either you
it does.
Something that's bothering you, or you love somebody that's got something that's bothering them.
Yeah.
And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember that they taught that for every alcoholic, there were four other people that were visibly affected by that alcoholism. And I would say that the same thing happens whether you're an overeater, an undereater, a sexaholic, a negative thinker, mm-hmm. whatever you're obsessed.
You know, and the opioid addiction now is growing to just epidemic proportions.
Absolutely. And I will just say that this program has the potential, if you do three things, of curing any and every addiction, including opioids. And those three things are: you got to want to get well, you got to believe you can, and you got to show up and do the work. The work's in the book. It's easy to do. And if you do those three things, I've never had a failure. So it's back on you now. If you want to get over opioid addiction or anything else, all you have to do is do this program. And Sherry, so tell them one more time what your website is. They can get your book at Amazon or any of the other booksellers.
Right. The book is Sweet Sorrow, and it's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. And my website is www.sherry, S-H-E-R-R-Y, Cormier, C-O-R-M-I-E-R, author, A-U-T-H-O-R.com.
There's no period or comma between your name and author?
No.
Okay. Well, there you have it. Go get a copy of Sweet Sorrow, and you will be ready to face loss after grief. Thank you, Sherry, so much for being on the program today.
Thank you, Wynn, so much. It was a pleasure.